Oops, there we go. Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, December 21st meeting of the General Plan Advisory Committee. We do have a quorum, so we are called to order. We'll start with a moment of silence. And we will now have the Pledge of Allegiance. First order of business this evening is election of chair and vice chair.
Yep, so we need nominations.
All right, so Santa Claus would like to nominate Susan Stewart.
Thanks, Santa. All right, so we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Vice Chair. Come on, folks. Rich, are you willing to do that?
Yeah.
I will second that nomination. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? And so we now have a chair and a vice chair. I want to welcome Joe Ingrafia to our board. He's coming from the Planning Commission. Should probably take a moment to say how sorry we are to have lost Dr. Taft. He brought a lot to both this committee and the Planning Commission, and we'll miss him. He was very wise, very experienced, but we'll carry on, and we're going to get this project done. Are there any announcements? Anybody? No? No. I wanted to make just a really quick statement. I know there was some concern about how many meetings we have not had in the fall, and just to let people know that it was not... I think there were a few things that happened, including the passing of Dr. Taft, that made a... kind of a challenge for us moving forward, but mainly I think we were hoping to get some input from the Coastal Commission on how far we'd gotten. So there was a concern that we didn't move forward making decisions or assumptions without knowing that we were on the right path, and Scott may address that at some point, but I'm assuming either we've heard we're on the path or we're just going to scoot ahead with our zoning and that sort of thing. And
yeah, I mean, we're entering probably the most interesting part of this. You know, we've up until this point, you've largely been looking at background documentation, right? And, you know, kind of wondering, like, what does all that mean? Well, we're starting to work on policy now, and that's what you're going to be seeing coming forward as we move forward is the actual policy language. And we've been working through draft language on the general plan LCP. In fact, we have an administrative draft at this point, but we're waiting to get to send it off to Coastal to get input from them before we have a public draft of that document to make sure that it looks like what they want it to look like and we have it ordered and configured the way that they expect and it has all the items that it needs to contain and that type of thing. So we'll be sending that off to them here shortly. And then part of that is and then the zoning code's a little bit different. We're breaking that down into modules, and you'll see a piece of that this evening, and Martha will present that to you. So you actually have the meat of the documents coming forward to you now, and so it'll be, I think, a little more interesting and be able to see what all that background work, resulted in. So with that, yeah.
Excellent. All right, so moving on, we have no presentations. We have public comment now for any items that are not on the agenda or something that is on the agenda that you can't stay for to approach later. So,
good evening. My name is Rick Moore. I'm a resident of Morro Bay.
And I welcome Mr. Ingrafia. I think that was a good choice to get him here. Anyway, I'm going to leave because I don't like the chairs here. And my only concern is I hear over and over, you know, maybe to go up 37 feet. And I think that's terrible. I don't like it in the residential. I wouldn't like it in the commercial. I think this is a small city. And it's not just a view that definitely will be taken from someone, but it's also light and air and everything else. You go up, and most people here know 25 feet, okay, so they buy something that's behind a single. They know that can go up, but there are people now buying two or three lots, and I don't know how all those rules are with the zoning. I don't understand it too well, but that's all. I'm very much against in this small little city for having buildings that's three and four floors up. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Rigmore. Anyone else?
Good afternoon, folks. My name is Steve Strait. I live at 190 Gilbert Street in Morro Bay. That's in the Beach Tract. I apologize for speaking up at this late date on issues you may have covered already. I just don't know about that. I have two issues that I'd like to bring up. One is a burning issue to me, and the other is less burning, maybe smoldering. The burning issue is about a block wall that I have on the side of my house. I live on a corner lot, so this block wall is 3 feet high, and it's adjacent to the curb, and it's in the street right-of-way. Now, I've owned this house and lived there since 2009. The house was built in 1959, and recently I received a compliance letter from the city. It appears that the wall has become it's been pointed out somehow, and it's become a problem. And I would like the city to take into account the existence of non-conforming structures like this when the new regulations, new and improved regulations, are devised. My second issue, the lesser important, is about short-term vacation rentals. Recently, I became aware that my next-door neighbor has a permit. It hasn't been a problem, and I'm hoping it never becomes a problem. There is a short-term vacation rental up the street from me about 200 feet away, and it occasionally is a problem. The occupants overflow their property sometimes, and they have excessive parking. They park in front of my house even, several hundred feet away. So evidently there is no noticing requirement for vacation rental permits. I would like to see some kind of a noticing process come into existence. I would like the city to study the possibility of having some kind of a density threshold, such as one of these permitted uses per block face, something that can't be exceeded. I also like to see a linkage between the number of occupants and the provision of on-site parking. Thank you for your consideration. That's all I wanted to bring up.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Bill Martini. And I spoke, I think it was a couple months ago, on Special Planning Area B. And I've since spoke to Scott on this, my concerns and that on the mapping down there. But there were several of you asked for where Special Planning Area B was, and next time you speak, to actually describe it. And so I thought I would take this opportunity for the ones that aren't familiar with the Special Planning Area B, just to kind of give you a little background and where it is located. It's located on Main Street at the southern end of town, from approximately the 200 block of Main Street to maybe 350 Main Street. It includes approximately 20 bayfront lots that go from Main Street down to the bay itself. This was a subdivision back in the 1920s, and it's actually about the only area in Morro Bay that's actually privately owned right to the waterfront. It's not leased property, so. And they have an actual special planning for this area, which stated at the back in the 1960s, 70s, this, I believe, was zoned commercial. In 1980, they rezoned the bulk of it residential with a thin, about a 50-foot strip on the waterfront, commercial. And one of my concerns is the original map shows, you know, the 50-foot strip on the waterfront, and these lots are about 300 feet deep, so 90% of it's residential. The current city map actually shows, and I just wanted to see if we could get it corrected, the waterfront commercial, it actually shows it as two-thirds of the lot and about one-third residential, so it's incorrect. And it even includes, in the outline, it includes some of the bay into the commercial zoning, you know, some of the water. So my main thing is to actually get the map correction so there's no confusion in the future. The zoning reads that everything below the bluff top is zoned waterfront commercial with an overlay, a PD overlay, and then the residential also has a PD overlay. And I know I've been told that this area is not going to change. It's going to, you know, the zoning's going to stay the same. But it's primarily getting the maps corrected to eliminate any confusion in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Anybody else? Any comments or discussion?
Scott, could you elaborate on Rigmore's comment on the 37-foot so the public would be aware of what's going on with that?
We have increases in height for the downtown area to encourage mixed-use development. Apparently I was talking too long. And so we've increased it to again, incentivize mixed-use projects, and you need taller buildings if you're going to have realistic commercial spaces. Most of the commercial spaces in our downtown have low ceiling heights, and so you really need ceiling heights in the 15, 16, 17 foot range to have really solid commercial businesses there on the retail side of things. That's usually what's desired in sort of Class A retail type establishments. So it would accommodate that and then would allow you to have a residence and or other business upstairs. And so that's where that comes from. A portion of, I think, the increase in height was also to pick up architectural features that would be on top of the building, that type of thing, cupolas, stuff like that.
I did also chat with the hotelier because I had some questions about the allowable square footage for that. And one of the things they pointed out was that with a three-story building that gets you your 30-foot, and we have it written in here that you do need an allowance to go an extra 6 or 7 feet to accommodate the elevator shafts and some of the equipment that would be on top. So it's not like you're going to have a solid block that's up to the 36 or 37 feet. You know, you'd have your ceiling and then hopefully, and they mention in here, you know, attractively disguised infrastructure that you would need to get to.
Yeah,
that
so we don't end up, because we have all the design guidelines talk about, you know, pitched roofs and pitched forms, and if you have it at, you know, 32 or 3 feet, you're not really going to get the three stories. You're not also going, and you're going to get flat roofs. You're not going to have pitched roofs, which is what seems to be the desire and the design guidelines and the discussions we've had to this point.
Yeah. And I believe I read in the Bay News last night that the new boutique motel is 37 feet. Is that correct or not?
Have any hotels in the pipeline right now?
Yeah, the one that's being built next to Frankie and Lola's.
Oh no, that one's it's below the level of the bluff.
All right, so the 37 is proposed. It's not
correct. It's not in place.
Yeah,
now. Yeah.
So it's in our new zoning code that we're bringing to.
as to Bill Martini's point, are we getting that map changed to make it?
We're aware of it, and it'll be approximate. Okay. We're not going to survey that in. I mean, it'll be written in by description as it is now. I think his concern is just that it shows it further up, and he's like, "Well, that's a larger area of commercial," but it's also the description. You have to read it together.
Okay.
The maps gives you a general idea about where it's at, but it really tells you where the line's drawn. So.
Okay.
But yeah, we're going to try to get it closer. So.
Okay. And the gentleman with his block wall, you're going to talk to him.
His issue is interesting. His block wall actually is fine from a height standpoint. It's 36 inches. Our current wall standard in front yards is 36 inches. We are proposing to change it to 4 feet. So you can provide comment on that this evening. But the wall is out in the right of way. It's been that way for years and years and years and years and years. But we received, we were dealing with a complaint and code enforcement issue over there with somebody that was building a fence that was too tall. And then they turned around, I guess, and looked at some of the other ones and filed similar complaints. That was identified as being in the right of way. And so we said, potentially, he can keep it. He just needs to get an encroachment, a special encroachment permit from our Public Works Department. He's fortunate. He isn't one of the ones that exceeded the height limitation right now. But we're not really going to do much. We received several complaints in the area where that gentleman's home was. We're not going to do much with any of that right now, other than the ones that are in the right of way. You do need to get an encroachment permit for those, because that indemnifies the city in case something were to happen. Say a car came around a corner too fast, crashed into the wall. They're likely going to, come after the city at that point, because the wall is in the city's right of way. Mm-hmm. And so we, as part of that special encroachment permit, you identify the city for those types of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else?
So are we going to entertain any grandfathering, or it'll be a case by case?
That's a great question. And it's one of the things, this issue that that gentleman ended up being sort of caught up in, brought to light. And that is, if you go around and we start enforcing, on, say, fence heights, I drove not only on the block on either side of where these complaints came in, but I went about 4 or 5 streets beyond that. And I think the number of non-compliant fences that I found was somewhere in the 40 to 50 range.
Wow.
It was about 45 or 47, I forgot which. Mm-hmm. And there were probably another 25 to 30 homes that had improvements that were out in the right-of-way that I didn't know if they had encroachment permits or not. And so getting back to your question, we probably do need to put something in the ordinance that would say, upon adoption, we'll consider these things non-conforming, and as they're rebuilt and those types of things, they would be rebuilt in a conforming manner. Because otherwise, as we came through these things, we'd be making a lot of folks tear stuff down and then rebuild fencing and things like that. And that's very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it would create a lot of turmoil, and I don't know that we're really after that. If we want to have a new standard or a different standard or enforce a standard, maybe we just do it from the adoption of the new code. It's an opportunity there that we wouldn't otherwise have. I mean, as it stands right now, if we just go status quo, then we'd have to go enforce on those folks. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks.
Scott, I have a question. With respect to the walls that are in the right-of-way, does that in turn push the parking further into the street? Specifically in this example, do people tend to park next to those walls?
So as you're aware, Morro Bay is not really in love with its sidewalks. We don't have many in the residential areas, right? And you see unimproved portions of the right-of-way with various treatments. Sometimes people pave them, sometimes they landscape them, so they do all different kinds of things to them. And it's different, it can be different house to house as you go up and down streets. So I guess, to your respect, if it was removed and it was left undeveloped and unplanted, then I suppose you could park in it. Some streets we have very wide right-of-ways, and even if they approve a portion of it, you can still park cars on either side and drive 2 cars down in both directions. Not an issue. Other areas of town, that's more of an issue, where we have the smaller lots up in North Morro Bay and that type of thing. Those are narrower streets, smaller lots. It could be more of an issue there.
Yeah, I think the only thing I'm thinking about is, bicyclists and kids on bicycles and people walking dogs if they start getting pushed into the street for any reason.
One more question. The gentleman had another question about the vacation rental ordinance that we'll be looking at. You know, as I was listening to him, it makes sense to me that the common complaint I've heard so far sitting up here has been the excessive people in a residence causing excessive parking on the street. Am I being too simplistic to think that we could actually put language that would tie to that you could only park on the property, so that would limit by default the amount of people that, or could you not do that?
Yes, you could do that. I mean, enforcement is not going to be easy, but yeah, you could do that.
Because, yeah, I mean, it just doesn't seem right that people can bring in 10, 12 cars.
Yeah.
You know.
So, yes, we could write that. Part of the policies could be that.
Which would reduce.
In addition to having, you know, separation between individual units, so you don't have over concentration, like four of them in a row in a residential neighborhood, those types of things. So, yeah, I mean, we could go through those things, and then we'll also have to have discussions about whether we have grandfathering for those or not, based on whatever policies we put in, because it will likely create issues with regard to the licenses that are out there, but we renew them every year. So literally the city could say, nope, this is the policy, and as they renew, that's the way it goes. And if yours doesn't get done in the order and you lose out, you lose out. I mean, that's what it just depends on what the city council wants to do.
Right.
What point will we be discussing that?
Within the next, you know, few
next
months.
Couple of meetings. Yeah. I think it's an important topic. I like the idea of a maximum density threshold. I think that was really smart move.
Well, if you confine the parking to the property, that that actually helps control the density, because they can only pack so many people in a car.
Right.
And so they would discourage them for these party houses that we see, or that are mainly the problem.
So. Scott, in North Morro Bay, like you said, there aren't very many sidewalks, and so some houses are built right to the edge of the street. I mean, some yards come to the edge of the street, and some are set back a little bit. So is there a city easement along the edges of those properties, and then their property line starts beyond the easement, or does their property line start at the street?
Very likely you have improvements that are in the actual right-of-way, which is why I said I drove around in that neighborhood, and I saw several properties in the area where there's unimproved right-of-way, where you shouldn't have improvements, where they had fences and rock, all sort of rock, you know, outlines of things, you know, kind of delineating their yard that was in the right, those things were in the right-of-way.
Uh-huh.
And some people just had plantings in them, and some people didn't have anything, and those people would park on it, or some people paved it and parked their car on it, as opposed to parking in the dirt or on the grass or whatever the case may be. And there's all of those scenarios are in any given street in Morro Bay where you don't have sidewalks. You know, South Morro Bay, we have larger lots, and oftentimes we have larger pieces of unimproved right-of-way in front of them. Some is so deep that you could almost park a car perpendicular in the unimproved portion of the right-of-way. In North Morro Bay, the unimproved portion of the right-of-way is less; it's not as wide typically, and so it would just allow you to maybe park a car parallel to the street.
So the ones that have landscaped out to the street or parked out to the street, they're actually doing that on city property, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so that would be grandfathered into because if they ever are going to put sidewalks or anything in there?
So the grandfathering would just apply to the existing fence height, those types of things. It wouldn't apply to other improvements. Any improvements that you have, if you put improvements in the right-of-way short of landscaping, the city would require you to get an encroachment permit, special encroachment permit, because of the liability issue. The moment you run into somebody's landscape rock that they put out there that's in the right-of-way, they might sue the city, and they might sue the homeowner and go after their homeowner's insurance, but they're going to absolutely sue the city because it was in the right-of-way.
Yeah.
So those are typically why we want to get, the special encroachment permits, because it gets the insurance attached to it. So.
And if they ever do get sidewalks up there, then they're just out of luck, right? Because the sidewalk has priority on that property.
Yeah, and the special encroachment permits require you to remove the improvements for the city ever to decide to ride in the road, put a sidewalk in, what have you. It does that as well.
This brings another question, because I was just recently the recipient of the current zoning when I built my house 2 years ago, but we're required to provide one parking space, street parking. So where mine is, it's going to be in the sidewalk when the sidewalk comes through. Yet for me to get a permit, I had to put that in. So are we going to be looking at that with our zoning, or when you come through with sidewalks, are you going to make me take out the parking that you made me do to get my permit?
Well, now the state's already gotten rid of
the
requirement.
See what I'm saying?
The state's already got rid of the requirement to have the parking space.
Oh, really? Before I built? No.
After. So anyway, good
answer.
When is the city getting sidewalks?
We're not getting sidewalks anytime
soon.
We're
not getting sidewalks. No.
And in fact, the people in Morro Bay, in general, since I've been here, most folks, they don't want them.
No.
Prefer to have the streets the way they are. It's more of a rural feel, I guess, maybe. And, mm-hmm. and you know, it's not as urbanized feel when you have that. And that seems to be, you know, the desire for most. I'm not going to say everybody likes that. Some people want sidewalks. But mostly what we hear and what Public Works hears is, you know, no, we don't want sidewalks. And why are you trying to put them in here or make us dedicate for those or what have you? So other than on collector streets and those types of things.
Just a plug for the Public Works, the ones that they put in this recent improvements, they were really appropriate in the places they put them in, and they really helped a lot.
We did some nice gap closure.
Especially down by the senior center, the senior apartments on Main. That's really nice that they tie that together for ADA.
Okay, let's move on to our consent calendar. We have to approve minutes for July 20th and August 17th. Any comments on those minutes? Joe, I'm sure you spent all of your free time watching both meetings on YouTube, but you can abstain. It's okay. So do I have a motion to approve minutes?
Let's go over something. You're not required to abstain if you weren't there. You can vote on them,
okay.
And I need you to vote on them if we're going to pass the minutes.
Okay.
Because you are a quorum, all of you. So while it's typical that the folks that were not there, like, oh, I don't want to say okay to because I wasn't there, but there's no requirement that you recuse yourself for them. You're allowed to vote on them, and I would request that you do so we don't get a backlog of minutes being stacked.
Okay, I move that we approve the minutes on the items A1 and A2 as read.
I'll second that. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. We've approved your minutes. No unfinished business. On to new business. We have Michael Baker with Amy presenting a PowerPoint.
Good afternoon, evening, everyone. Nice to be here. It's been a while. So I'm going to go over a brief status update, as we usually do, let you know where the other parts of the project are that we haven't talked about yet. Martha is going to introduce Module 2 of the zoning standard. Well, we're calling them zoning standards. There's a variety of items that are included there, and she'll get into the detail of that. And then finally, I'm going to present to you our draft poster for the lateral access task, which was part of the grant that we received most recently from the Coastal Commission, and we'll have a discussion about that. As Scott mentioned, we are very close to having the second draft of Plan Morro Bay ready, and that will go to the Coastal Commission for their initial review. They have a second review that is their official review. This is, like Scott said, a chance for them to give us some initial feedback, like they've done on some of the other components of the project so far. And then we will take that feedback and prepare the public draft during the first quarter of next year. The next step on the zoning code would be the additional regulations that you aren't seeing tonight, as well as the allowed uses. And the environmental impact report is getting underway. I think some of you, I don't know if any of you were at the scoping meeting, but we did have a scoping meeting in November. And the scoping period, the notice of preparation circulation period has ended. That was on December 8th. So Rincon Consultants, who is leading the EIR effort, is now getting underway with that EIR. And I'm going to hand it off to Martha to talk about zoning.
Thank you. As we continue our review of the preliminary drafts of zoning standards, I wanted to just first remind ourselves, as always, of why the city is undertaking the zoning code update. And especially with this one, not only consistency with the general plan and the coastal land use plan, but particularly with the district regulations that we'll be talking about today, some important objectives are that high quality design, as well as community concerns about neighborhood character. So we'll be highlighting those. Those are two of the important objectives that this section is particularly related to. We did change the order around a little bit of how we are approaching the review of the preliminary regulations. So last time I was here, we talked about administration and permits. And then we were going to go on to citywide regulations and then leave the district standards for at the end, because waiting for the general plan to get further fleshed out. There's so much interest, though, in the district regulations, particularly the development standards. We decided to bring those forward earlier, along with some interpretation provisions and definitions, kind of those reference pieces, to help with the review of the rest of the zoning standards, but then also get these district regulations out, because people are having a hard time thinking about anything else. What that just means is that later in the process, we'll take another pass through just to make sure we are consistent with what comes out with the general plan and the local coastal program. So that's why we are here with interpretation provisions, district development standards, general site regulations, and definitions. Yep.
Martha, your rearrangement as you're presenting it to us, well, I'm assuming will have nothing to do with how it's packaged at the end as when it's produced.
Great.
Okay.
Yep. We'll still stick with the same overall framework. It's just we're reviewing these in those kind of discrete chunks, and then we'll package it all together and take another look at it. All right, so I'll just I'm going to go through a summary of what's in your packet. One thing, another change I wanted to point out is there was some interest in having some knowing about what changed from what's existing to what's proposed in here. And as we've expressed before, that's really a difficult task because this is a comprehensive update, and your code is so old, so outdated, so poorly structured. It's just a strikeout, underline. Complete replacement. But what we did with this is within each chapter or section provided some annotations of what the changes are, whether it's primarily carrying forward existing or if there are substantial changes or things are all new. In the district specific standards, where possible, we did show red line and strikeout things like where there was a direct change. So that is one change with the approach to these. So the first section is the set of interpretation provisions. So these are all, you know, reference pieces for help in interpreting the code, implementing the code, measuring things, coming up with, you know, if somebody has a question of something, there's maybe a question if something applies. This is the rules that staff will turn to. So first is just general rules about interpretation of language, and these are fairly standard provisions. The next set is a set of rules of measurement, and these primarily carried forward what the city either has codified or what the city does in practice for how things are measured, such as height, slopes, floor area, so on. In a lot of cases, there's a lot more detail or clarity provided because things weren't articulated in your existing code, or, you know, questions that often came up and staff had to answer. So things like determining average slope, additional detail in determining floor area are included. Some changes is in lot coverage, there's an exception to allow one small accessory structure up to 120 square feet, less than 8 feet in height, is exempt from lot coverage. And kind of the reason for this is below the threshold for what is required for a building permit. And it's also kind of the temporary sheds people might get at Home Depot or so. So it's one of those things that occurs commonly. It's kind of an administrative difficult task for staff to keep track of those. So there is an exception built in for one of those. And then there are new provisions for calculating floor area ratio and measuring the number of stories in a building. So that's kind of that overall set of interpretation provisions. The next is the district standards, which are district regulations, and I'll go through each one of those. The general format for each of those, though, begin with a purpose and an applicability section, and this is where it really explains the intent of the district and can help with interpretation when there's some kind of question that comes up to guide that, that administration of regulation. So it's trying to provide that bridge between the general plan land use designation and then the zoning district. The next set is the land use regulations, which Amy indicated would be in a future module, which will go through what uses are permitted in each district and what the permit requirement is. And then there's the development regulations, which have things such as the lot and density standards, dimensional requirements, and so on. So each district is set up similarly. So the first district is the agriculture district, and this really just carries forward existing provisions. No substantial changes are proposed. If you look at your current standards for this and look at how they're presented here, there's a big difference. We think they're a lot more legible and easy to understand and interpret this way. But again, the substance of those regulations has not changed, was not proposed to change. The next set of districts is the residential districts. And first I want to kind of talk about how we looked at kind of categorizing the residential district, because there is a lot of discussion about, you know, throughout the city, there's really different neighborhoods that have a distinct different character. And so we started looking at those different characters and, you know, analyzing the neighborhoods and why those different look and feel and different pattern of development. And what it really kind of came down to, and this map is included in your packet of the residential lots by size, is that there's real distinct patterns of lot sizes through the city in the residential district. So up at the very north here, very small parcels, really, you know, really maximum size almost about 2,500 square feet. So very small lot pattern. In the middle here, the yellow, you have kind of a more of a mid-range, you know, 2,500 to about 4,300 square feet. Then the more orange areas are where you get into some larger lot sizes, either, you know, between 4,300 and 6,000 or, you know, greater than 6,000. And then when we overlaid your existing residential zones and overlays on top of those really kind of followed this pattern. So the R1S1 district really encaptured, you know, this area of those very small lots. Whereas when we got into the next larger sizes, those were the R1, S2. So in a way, your residential zoning was kind of based on these neighborhoods. And then when we, and that makes sense because you would have different standards. If you have a 2,500 square foot lot, you might have smaller setbacks than you would have on a 6,000 square foot lot, because just you have less space to deal with. So in a way, your existing district standards really reflected your individual neighborhood patterns. However, when you get larger lots within these neighborhoods or somebody consolidated a couple lots, that's where you start to have a problem, because if most of the lots are, say, 2,000 square feet, then someone comes in, buys a couple, consolidates them, has 8,000 square feet. Now if they're building to that small setback, they can build a very massive house in that area, which now looks out of place. So what we're proposing to do is take this same idea of, you know, different allowances or requirements for different lot sizes, but tie it to the lot size versus the area. And then that way, what gets built on that lot is appropriate to that lot and scaled either up or down proportionally to it. So what that does is, so where you have your R1, S1 existing zoning, those basically turn into standards for lots that are sized 2,500 square feet or less. So those are your very small lot standards that are appropriate for very small lots. what was now your R1 S2 zoning, which kind of the, I mean, they're still small, but in a way mid-range. Those standards now apply to lots that are between the 2,500 and 4,300 square feet. And then your R1 standards are for lots that were 4,300 square feet or greater than 4,300 square feet. And then you have another area, this R1 S2A, which is really a unique area specifically. Those just keep its regular standards. So that's kind of how things are proposed to be reorganized in your residential district standards. So then with that, so that's how things got carried forward. And then with that, there's some refinements. A couple of things were refining setback standards to get, where possible, where there is a predominant lot pattern, to get rid of the percentage calculation. So right now, in the R1 district, the side setback was 10% of lot width, minimum of 3, maximum of 5. Well, that's kind of an administrative headache sometimes, always calculating that 10%, and it's a different number for everyone. Well, the predominantly these were 50-foot wide lots, so we said, okay, let's just make it the 5. There was another area that had a 10% lot width standard. We looked at, you know, picking just a number for that, couldn't come up with the right number that fit all the situations, so decided that it was best to keep for that area the 10% requirement. So again, where possible, trying to go with this notion of making things easier to use, implement, and understand. Some other adjustments to the residential development standards is to adjust the residential high density density allowance to 27, and that's consistent with what we're anticipating coming through with the general plan. And then also requiring some minimum open space requirements for multi-unit development. So each unit is required to have, depending on which district you're in, either 250 or 150 square feet of open space. Yeah, if you look on page 17 of the actual standards, and I believe these open space numbers are also consistent with what's anticipated in the general plan. So then also included in the, for the residential districts, are supplemental standards that are really looking at the quality of design. And these are all new standards. There's limitations on the amount of paving in the in street-facing yards. For residential development, there's some requirements for window and balcony placement, trying to get at the idea of privacy notions, respecting privacy of neighbors. There's some additional standards on for single-unit detached development, really looking at on small lots, incorporating some standards to get some articulation and some better design in to help reduce massing, the appearance of massing. There's also additional standards for attached single unit or multi-unit development, looking at building design, orientation, building length, again, that articulation standard. So these are all standards to help get to that better design quality. There's also standards for small lot, single unit development. So this is, in a way, a lot of people think of this as like a PUD, so a way of getting multiple units on smaller lots, but single unit detached. So it has some development standards specific to that development type, and then required findings that would need to be made. And this is the idea that if these kinds of projects are done right, it's something that the city would like to see. So those standards replace what is now the compact infill development and your community housing standards.
So I think it was in here, but I'll just ask. In a community development project like that where you'd have multiple units on the acre, do we have some things in here that allow for, say, parking to be done around the edges on the outside of that development so that each unit doesn't have to have a garage or parking space? I mean, they'd have a dedicated space, but it's sort of not necessarily right in front of their house and would be outside, so they walk into that.
Well, we could clarify that, so to have some common parking area. It is possible through this. It's just not particularly articulated, which we could do. But also, these typically wouldn't happen on something that is as large as an acre. And staff might be able to weigh in where they've kind of the typical size where you'd see these types. Maybe 20,000?
I mean, those are I think that's where we use them, is on the smaller lots, right? Mostly on things that are, like you were saying, Martha, under an acre, under half an acre typically, probably.
I had a really interesting meeting with my insurance agent the other day, and she'd gone up to a huge conference for farmers agents up in Quebec, and they were projecting that within the next 10 to 20 years, they're going to see a massive decline in personal ownership of vehicles to the point where they feel that auto insurance will actually be a very changed industry. People will not have to have private insurance, so they're actually looking already at partnering up with car manufacturers, because the cars will come with insurance, so that there will be more of, you know, Uber, Lyft, self-driving cars. And it's not that far in the future, and they're already looking at, you know, seriously, a huge organization at planning for the next 10 to 20 years to make sure that they're still a viable industry. But it made me think, you know, and it's not necessarily just that, gee, we're all going to have mass transit. It's that the whole, you would call up and say, I need to, you know, get your hovercraft to take me to Albertsons or whatever. Well, so it was an interesting concept. Mm-hmm. And again, that this is a big organization that's already looking at that.
Yeah.
So, kind of on the same line as Susan, we have talked, I think we touched a little bit a few months ago on even considering the need of, or the requirement for garages. So are we going to be still looking at that holistically or just for R1?
We'll be looking at that with parking regulations. So that will be separate.
Parking regulations, yeah. We're going to do
that. And through that, we'll talk about our, you know, what needs to be provided for a single unit dwelling.
Right, which ties in with our stormwater and everything else, because the less concrete, the more we can absorb that water on the property.
Yeah, I mean, from the garage standpoint, we've had this conversation, and Joe can you know, attest to this. At the Planning Commission level, like we have the standard that single-family homes, you know, on certain size lots and above are required to have two enclosed parking spaces. And then we have a whole bunch of these houses in town and these smaller lots that don't have those. So every single one of them is not conforming. And then every single one of them needs a parking exception. And then we take these things ridiculously to the planning commissioner. Like, here, they're adding on 250 square feet and they also need a parking exception. And, like, what do you think? And the planning commissioner looks at me like, yeah, that's good. You know, so we're going to try to remove those types of things out of one, get rid of the parking requirement to have the two spaces in a garage. And then, two, the eliminate the requirement that those types of things go to Planning Commission, because they don't really need to see stuff like that. That's really stuff your staff can do.
I agree with that, but at the same time, we're going to have to balance that with the earlier discussion on the vacation rentals. Regardless of a garage, they still need to have the parking on site on their lot, you know, to do that. So that would still apply for the R1, right? Even if we didn't do garages, they'd still have to have.
You could still requirement, yeah.
Like,
parking,
what it
spaces,
is, two-car
right.
Garage for how many bedrooms, two or more?
It's not by bedroom.
It's not by bedroom. How is it done?
It's literally, what's the minimum lot? It goes two bedrooms at what size lot?
It's based on single-family homes. I think what you're thinking of is if it's apartment buildings. So if someone were to build a 20-unit apartment building and they're all one-bedroom units, then it's one parking spot's required. So that's how we do that, by bedrooms only on apartments.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Like single-family homes under 1,000 square feet are only required to have one enclosed parking space or something like that?
Only certain.
Yeah, but only with some of the smaller lot, with the overlays we were talking about just a minute ago. So
the bottom line, we're going to be cleaning all that up, making it easier for the Planning Commission.
You can't tell I'm excited about this, right? I mean, I do a lot of unnecessary work as a result of having sort of poor codes.
All right. So the residential districts, just to kind of summarize, just a change in approach of or organizational structure of how the different standards are applied. Refinements to primarily setback and density and standards and some requirements for open space, and then a set of new standards all related to design, orientation, and layout of residential development. So the next set of districts is the commercial and mixed-use districts. And so this includes the neighborhood commercial, community commercial, district commercial, which is your downtown, and visitor serving commercial. The development standards include increases in density allowance, again consistent with your what's anticipated in your general plan. Increased height in the, it's the CC district, sorry, that's the downtown. Yeah, sorry, not the district commercial. So CC, increased height in the CC district to 37 feet. And I would say this is, kind of going on the earlier conversation, not so much to allow additional stories, but to allow, and not even incentivize mixed-use development, but to allow it. The current demands of, again, Class A retail space, building standards, building types and design, keeping it at the 30 feet, it's real hard to get mixed-use development in there. And if you do, it's squished in, and that design doesn't come out. It ends up looking a little kind of funky, typically. There is some cleanup to the setback standards, and it's interesting when you actually start to look at the requirements and start writing them out. I said, what is this zero with an average of 2? How do you apply that kind of setback? We just simplified that, and it's just a 0 required setback. Saved staff from some averaging. Some other additions here were minimum open space requirements for residential units in mixed-use development. These requirements are slightly less than in the, the residential areas, recognizing you're in a different type of area and with a different intensity of development. And then there's some additional standards for required building location and frontage improvements in your downtown area in the CC district. And this is because this is really your pedestrian-oriented area. We want to have buildings located close to the street, have some frontage improvements for the sidewalk or outdoor dining and seating areas, or some nice landscaping. So those development standards have been included. Then
where are the open space requirements in the document?
Page 25.
Oh, there it is, up on top.
So could I ask a question, too, before we go too much further? And maybe it's just I'm confused, or maybe it's a typo. But in table 1706030, the development standards, uh-huh, under visitor serving commercial, the maximum lot coverage is 60, so that would be for hotels. And that's where I did call up a few hoteliers and say, is that even viable? And they kind of suggested that's not, that generally they cover 90 to 95% of the lot with the building, assuming underground parking. So I was confused. If you're giving 90% maximum coverage to district commercial retail, why would you drop it to 60 for a hotel? I mean, was that...
And we'll look at that. So that would be the what's existing now in the visitor serving commercial district. That doesn't mean that all hotels are in the visitor serving commercial district. But we'll look at the general plan land use designation map, look at where these areas are, and see if that's appropriate. Some of these visitor-serving commercial lots are some of the larger lots that help me describe this area. Aren't there some?
Give us an example.
By the school.
Near like the wastewater treatment plant, and and they aren't the ones kind of downtown where you could have, so on those larger parcels where you could get some development and you'd have surface parking, but we can look at that.
Okay.
Question: an applicant who wants to do a commercial development, how is it decided whether he falls within district commercial or community commercial?
These are all location-based, so you're in one district. We don't have the zoning map because we don't have the general plan land use designation map. But it's your entire city will be divided into districts, so you will know it's location-based. And generally, the downtown is community commercial.
Are we changing the boundaries of those districts or not? I remember we saw some maps of some of that occurring.
Yes.
Some boundaries are changing. Some descriptions of those areas are changing.
Right.
It's not dramatic, but we have made some changes.
Yeah.
We just don't have the zoning map prepared yet.
That's fine.
It'll look very much like, it's going to look similar to the land use map that you've seen several times. It just won't be land use based. It'll have these designations that Martha was discussing. It'll be the zoning map.
So there would be a provision that says your idea for a 15,000 square foot retail entity couldn't work because it's too large for community commercial?
Well, I mean that's the case now. That part doesn't really change. It really gives you a lot coverage that you can have depending on where the lot's located and what zoning classification that it's in. So there's lot coverage limitations now, and there will be when we implement the new. It's all different names, and the boundaries of them change a little bit, but. We're moving those things forward.
So do you remember offhand if Patascadero Road across from the high school, there's apparently a big lot property for sale. Is that considered visitor-serving commercial? What would that fall under?
That is.
Yeah, that's the vacant one east of the high school.
Adjacent to the freeway?
Right.
Yeah, that's
highway.
And it's in a planned development overlay. And
yeah.
And really this evaluation is done no differently than today. Someone were to call me at work today and say, hey, I'd like to build a 15,000 square foot hotel and I'm interested in this parcel, I look up what the land use is and then the appropriate zoning for that parcel, and then that tells me as a planner what the allowed land use is and what uses are permitted consistent with that land use.
Well, what John Solu pointed out was that I think it's a 1.2 acre parcel and that it's going for $1.7 million, and that if you're trying to put in a 60 to 75 room hotel, you'd be paying $30,000 for a room. I mean, you know him with numbers. He's like whipping it out there, and it just wouldn't pencil out with only 60% coverage, that you couldn't get that number of rooms in. So I don't know whether, again, you know, this was just an off-the-cuff conversation. But it might be something to look at, the coverage in the rooms. And, I mean, obviously you don't want massive, I don't know what, Holiday Inn or something, you know, that kind of massive structure. But you've got to make it pencil out for developers to do that.
Well, yeah, but there also has to be some logic on why we came out with 60% coverage, too. And what is that logic now? Or was it just we inherited from the county when we got these regulations?
I'm not sure what it is now. It might be close to that. Some of that financial analysis also may be reflective of today's economy in asking prices, and that some of that is not so much a city issue because that's what someone is asking for a particular piece of real property. Yeah, I don't know about the 60% what it is now. I don't know off the top of my head.
Well, this should be the existing carried forward. I don't know what the basis was for that, but we can re-look at it.
I think
that's good input.
I would look at that because, you know, if you're saying, well, but you could put in a big shopping mall and cover 90%, but if you're putting in a hotel, you could only cover 60%. Like, why? Why would you make that?
Well, some reasons probably deal with the height limitations in the area, the idea that they were going to, that they would have a parking lot out front, not below the structure. We don't really, we have one or two facilities that have underground parking, and that's in town. It becomes more viable over time, but I don't know that we're going to be getting any of those types of facilities in town anytime soon. So it's those types of things. So it just kind of depends on what type of facility you're building.
Okay.
So we can get something back from that, more information on it.
Because when
you get the 60%, and then there's only still the minimum open space is still 150 square feet. So it's not like trying to figure out the logic on how they came up with 60 versus 90, and I don't see anything that jumps out that makes it easily understood.
Okay. So the next set in the supplemental standards, the next section in the commercial mixed-use district, these are all new except for some provisions for rooftop view decks that was very specific and included in your current zoning. We carried that forward. But the rest of the supplemental standards really are arranged at some building transparency, having some openings where a building faces a street, exterior building materials and colors, pedestrian access. There are additional supplemental regulations specific to the community commercial, neighborhood commercial, and visitor serving commercial, which have to do with building orientation, having entrances, having parking located, behind buildings wherever possible. Again, getting at that, you know, these are the areas we want to have some pedestrian activity and some vibrancy. So I want to make sure that the buildings are addressing the street.
So, Martha, can you elaborate more on the building materials and colors, what we're going to be looking at with that?
So this has some general things because this is the standards, and there would be design guidelines to complement those, and it's hard to dictate building materials and colors through standards unless you're Santa Barbara and you have red tile roof and stucco. But it's basically requirements for a unified palette of quality materials on all sides of the buildings, so making sure there's four-sided treatment, and then having stone, brick, stucco, concrete block, something painted, that are durable materials approved through design review. So it's really some basic parameters, understanding that it would go through design review, and at some point you would have some really well-done design guidelines to provide further direction.
I hate to bring this up because I don't want to jinx us, but this is a 40-year plan or whatever. In Escondido, we had to change, and we had to actually implement some, for the commercial, some graffiti removal treatments to the buildings as part of the process to deter the graffiti. And I know we don't have that here, and I don't think we'll ever have it, but do we need to think about that longer term?
I mean, graffiti's not a huge issue in town. I mean, it's not something that we get a lot of calls on, I think, so I don't know. I mean, you're putting policies in that, I'm not sure what the benefit of them necessarily would be. We would expect any of the properties to clean, if they had graffiti, to clean them up, and that's usually what happens. It's not so prevalent that they need to have special treatments, I think, to the buildings to address them. I don't see it as being that prevalent.
We could always come back and amend.
We don't have it. We do have some, but usually we get it cleaned up. When we get the complaints come in, we get it cleaned up pretty quick. And not really.
Yeah, we do.
It's usually small.
So we could always come back later and amend to add that if it got bad.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah, hopefully it doesn't. You're right.
Good.
Okay, Martha, back to the colors.
Yep.
The building materials and colors. It says in the dot papers that they have to be complementary colors, a palette of complementary colors on a building. That just pertains to that building, right? What if you want to put in your building is beige and stuff and your neighbor wants to put in shades of blue and green. Those don't have to complement, right? Separate buildings can be separate colors.
Right, and this is just talking about your building and it's a unified palette.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we're still not going to have a design review component in our zoning that will control the color palettes throughout the commercial area then.
Right, this won't have any menu of appropriate
so
colors.
So someone, no. Does it, no one reviews the colors at all when somebody submits something?
No, it does get, it is part of the architectural review authority that the Planning Commission has when they review projects. And larger projects, they're mandated to provide color boards, material boards, and the Planning Commission often makes comments about, hey, that doesn't look correct, or you need to, as Martha was saying, carry that feature around. In our residential design guidelines, have pieces like that you have to wrap them around, like at least the corners on the front, so the buildings that are visible. In commercial areas, the buildings tend to be much more visible, and you want to wrap consistent materials around the building. But those are commentary that the Planning Commission often makes. Also, when we're done with all of this process, we'll probably be moving forward. It's a desire of the Planning Commission. Joe can attest to this again. That's why he's here. There's a desire to implement and put in place commercial design guidelines. We have residential ones right now, and to do commercial ones. We do have some commercial design guidelines in the downtown and waterfront strategic plan. So in the downtown and the waterfront, we have some that are in there. That's our first step towards that. And then these add a little bit of, you know, extra, you know, teeth have things that the Planning Commission, direct what the Planning Commission will be looking at when projects come forward, and staff when we bring projects forward as well. So this is us sort of walking in that direction. I mean,
sure.
Yeah.
And I'm asking some of these questions based on our public community meetings we had. There was that overwhelming consensus at the meeting that you and I were at where the people wanted that eclectic feel in the downtown, the old town of Morro Bay. But like Martha's saying, I mean, it can be eclectic, but you want the three sides covered. You just don't want a little old Western facade sticking out there that's going to fall, you know. It really needs to kind of still look like it. Somebody thought about this stuff before
right.
they did it? Yeah. Okay.
So I have a question about how this would operate. So I'm imagining there would be a commercial design guidelines. I've seen an example. They go on for 20 pages or so. And that would get triggered every time somebody decides to do a commercial development in Morro Bay?
So these, in general, would apply to commercial development. We have residential design guidelines that apply to single-family homes. The next step would be to do multifamily design guidelines and commercial design guidelines that apply citywide. We have partially adopted design guidelines in the downtown and waterfront strategic plan. They're far more than we've ever had in the past. I mean, that's, you know, you might have heard Commissioner Luer on the Planning Commission state, we need more, but it's like, we'll get more eventually, but this is much more than the city's ever had. I mean, we can use these now that they're adopted. So as projects come forward, these are tools you get to use to point to. And they're tools that the city didn't have before. That's another step toward having full-blown design guidelines for commercial development. So I do see us going down that road. It's the desire of the Planning Commission, and I think the council's interested in that too. It'll be after we're done with this, though, not while it's going on or before it's done. And it won't be incorporated into the zoning code or the general plan or the coastal program. It'll be a standalone, separate document because you want the flexibility to be able to change them and review them periodically, like once a year, once every 2 years, whatever, to see if the policies in them work. Because as you use them, you're like, man, that one's not very good. We should get rid of that and replace it with something else or what have you. So you want it to be flexible and be able to be changed frequently, you know, as you go
through. Would the purview of that be shared between the Planning Commission and the Community Development Office, or would it be...
When we adopt design guidelines, it would be staff. We use that as part of the review process that we go through. And if it's something that goes to Planning Commission, then your staff report will reflect. Okay, here's all of the policies that are applicable in our design guidelines. You see this now in Planning Commission staff reports. These are all the policies, the design guideline policies that we think, staff thinks, apply to this project. And here's how they're compliant or not compliant. Or here's issues that we see where they're not quite compliant. They're design guidelines, remember, they're not hard and fast. You absolutely have to do every single one of these. It's in general, these are the things we'd like to see, and these are the things we'd like to avoid, and here's some treatment options that you can do to avoid these things, like from massing issues, you can push a portion of the second floor back a little bit, or that type of thing, and so it's those types of things.
Sound good? All right. So for the industrial district standards, these are really carrying forward the existing standards for your M1 and M2 districts, which would become your IG, your industrial general, and your ICD, industrial coastal dependent. So no real changes to those. The public and semi-public districts, there's a bit of a different approach towards these, and related to that then some changes in standards. So right now what your zoning does has some very specific zones that are really more uses. They're not zoning districts. You have a school zone and you have a golf course zone, which we're proposing and consistent with your general plan to be instead a little more broad, where you'd have a public facility zoning district, a park and recreation zoning district, and then an open space zoning district. And so we incorporated development standards for the open space district because there were none existing. And then the school zone, which is becoming a more general public facility zone, looking at some refinements to those standards, allowing, changing the height limit from 25 to 30 feet and getting rid of the maximum lot coverage for flexibility and recognizing there may be some more uses than just schools in that area. Similarly, with the park and recreation zone, modifying the golf course specific height from 14 feet to 25 feet and getting rid of that maximum lot coverage, again, recognizing in these active park and recreation areas you'd have more than just golf courses. So those are the changes for those. Next is the waterfront and harbor area district.
Excuse me, Martha.
Yep.
On the maximum height, so the open space is 17, you're keeping it at 17.
Well, that's brand new. There isn't
that's
anything
new?
Existing.
Okay, that's a new one. That's right, yeah.
Yep.
I had it right in my head the first time. So basically that's limited to a one-story building with
right.
a high roof.
Right.
Okay. Which seems appropriate for open space. Yeah.
Yeah. Bathrooms or restroom or maintenance.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. The waterfront and harbor area districts are your existing commercial fishing, harbor, and waterfront districts, and these are really proposed to be carried forward. No substantial changes proposed to those districts. Those are fairly specific districts and not looked at as major change areas.
Is the, without looking real quick, but I'm just thinking about the proposed boat haul-out, do our regulations are adequate to cover that? Should that go through?
I don't see any issue with if we are able to bring that forward.
Okay.
But yeah.
On the maximum building height on the west side of the Embarcadero, it's only 17 feet. There are a lot of buildings on the Embarcadero that seem to be higher than 17 feet. Like.
Like
the one like Marina Square is
right. Yeah. So the base height is 17 feet on the west side, but because it's in a planned development overlay, you can go to 25 feet with a finding of greater than normal public benefit. And so all of those two-story buildings you see on the west side, it's because there was some significant public benefit like public access, public bathrooms,
if this was in the past, so it still is going on because like new developments that are being planned down like where Off the Hook is, that's going to be
right.
two stories, that's going to be higher than 17 feet.
Yes, so they'll apply for a height exception to go to 25 feet. Planning Commission will look at that and can only approve the 25 feet with a finding of significant public benefit. And so all of those applications, they have to show what kind of significant public benefit there would be, and that we've had that, you know, for years.
There's other standards. It implements the waterfront master plan.
Yeah.
Which is in place, and inside of that, there's the requirements for as you go taller, you have to have wider view corridors, and if you have a single story building, then you can have narrower view corridors, and there's a lot of things that go into it, which is why we didn't really seek to change it, because then we'd be amending the master plan too, and so we sort of left it as it was because folks didn't really seem to want taller buildings down there.
But they have it written 17, but if you allow a building to for the public benefit to be 25 feet, then it's going to be that way in perpetuity, right? Because another building is not going to probably be shorter.
Well, it says 17 or otherwise 25. I mean, it has both of it in the table.
Right.
Or otherwise. So that it can't go higher than 25.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. The language explains the public benefit, what they have to meet be public benefit?
So to some extent, yes, it does. And to some extent, no, it does not. And it's one of the things that we need to do. The waterfront master plan is old, not unlike our codes.
Okay.
And it needs to be updated too. So one of the action items that comes out of our general plan LCP update is go update those codes, or go update that master plan. And so that'll be one of the things we do in the future is to bring it up to date where we can clarify that a little better, because I don't think it's very well clarified. It has some bad exhibits in it that talk about when you go up taller and how you have to pitch the roof and things. It's the view corridor thing is the examples are not good. So
yeah, but in, you know, tagging on what Jan was talking about. So for now, between now and we're not finishing this thing till the end of 18, realistically, right? And then you would be 19 that you'd be working on at the earliest, going back to do the harbor plan. What does a person do when they come in? Like, for example, the current proposals, like, well, the Libertine, it was up, now it's back, I don't know, and with the Otter Rock and the off the hook. Is there guidance now that tells them what they have to do to be a public benefit? And is that going to just stay as the rule until you go and change that other plan?
Well, they can come up with all kinds of things to do extra public benefit. The question, what we will be defining better is, it requires you to do all these things that actually are public benefit, you know, by widening view corridors and providing lateral access, which, you know, the map talks about there. We'll get to later. You know, it requires you to do these things, and those are public benefit, but you have to go over and above that. And so what the Waterfront Master Plan doesn't do is a great job of explaining that. And so we have to, when we talk to the leaseholders when they're coming forward, or we go out to the RFP, the folks that are proposing, we explain that to them, that, you know, that's the minimum standards is what's in the Waterfront Master Plan. The extra is, I'm going to put a public view deck on the top of our building so the public can stand up and sit up there and view the rock. That's extra, right? We're going to put tables out here that are just for the public. That's extra. That's not required by the policies, but that's extra. So it's things like that. Or we're going to have a wider view corridor that goes out to the ocean than is otherwise required. Again, extra. Those are the types of things that we want to make explicit in the master plan process, because it's not explicit now.
And as it stands today, then they take that to Planning Commission first, they approve it, Coastal Commission and Council, the three agencies.
It goes Planning Commission, City Council, off to Coastal, and then back to Planning Commission right now. We're going to be at least removing one of those steps, because permitting authority is going to be given back to the city for the land side on the west side of the Embarcadero. Coastal doesn't want it anymore.
Hey, Scott, I don't recall in the Planning Commission, in the 2 years that I've been there, where we've actually approved a second story on the Embarcadero that wasn't there before.
So the last time we took a Planning Commission two-story Embarcadero West Side project was, I want to say, August of 2015, when the Planning Commission approved the precise plan for the demo reconstruct of Morro Bay Landing. They're in for building permit applications, and they're probably 80% of the way with their building permit, so the city will see on the northern Embarcadero soon to be a two-story building over there. But they got their concept approval, which is the first PC meeting, many years prior, and the reason why there was such a long timeline of years is because of the time it takes to get through the Coastal Commission process. came back to the city finally in 2015. Mm-hmm. And then the last 2 years have been building permit work.
And this analysis did go on for the Gray's Inn project that you did see. You did sit on the commission for that. I mean, we didn't add anything to it, but we gave you the analysis as to whether it complied or didn't. That one doesn't comply with the view corridor requirement. It's not wide enough. We had that whole discussion. Yeah. And the planning commission's like, open up the view corridor. We don't want the plants there. We don't want that storage thing there. You guys went through it and, you know, opened it up as much as you could and made those requests for additional improvements there. So you have seen that component of it. It did the analysis, but we didn't add a second story. It was already there.
Yeah, that's my point is that, you know, typically we're looking very closely at the benefits that are being conveyed to the public, and you know, I don't really recall that we sacrificed any or much in the way of view. I guess all I'm saying is that I would imagine that the complexion of the commission is pretty conservative, and that it better be some fairly obvious benefits if we're going to impact the view. Yeah.
Yeah, and several of the most recent Embarcadero projects, like, say, going back the last 5 years, they've all been single-story or existing two-story. In the pipeline coming forward, some of the things that the Planning Commission will see probably in the next year, they're all remodels of existing single-story development or dock development. The only thing you'll see, Roses Landing went, but that's an existing two-story. So, yeah, there is some concern about two stories on the west side of the Embarcadero, but it doesn't happen that often. That Morro Bay Landing project was approved in 2008, so that was quite some time ago, and we don't anticipate anytime soon a new two-story.
I think the good thing I've noticed is that the balance of driving force has been for any rebuilds or whatever of the second story has been to incorporate more, increasing our motel rooms, which is a positive benefit for our tax base. So that's, you know, I mean, we got to balance it with it with the views, but that's a good thing, I believe.
It's actually one of our goals.
All right, the next set of regulations are general site regulations. These apply citywide. So there are site regulations that are applicable to land with either in some zones or all zones regardless of use. So I'll go through quick summaries, mainly focusing on changes, so stop me at any point. The first section is for accessory structures, and these are current provisions that are applicable to accessory buildings and guest houses are carried forward. We did clarify some limitations on laundry and sink utility plumbings and bathrooms, and that's really to ensure that accessory structures are not used for habitation unless they're specifically allowed to. Then there's another provision that roofed accessory structures may not be located in the front of a main building on the site. So putting those accessory buildings in the rear of the site.
That's any size that incorporates the 120 square foot size you talked about earlier? As far as those roofed accessory structure in the front of the main building.
Right.
Sorry.
Right. Yeah. Any roofed accessory
structure.
It also
includes accessory right. buildings. Okay.
Right.
The ones that are excluded from building permit.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
The next section is agriculture land preservation, and these are really your existing provisions that look at preserving both prime and non-prime agricultural land. The next section is on archaeological yes?
I'm sorry. I just have one question. On the bottom, page 39, where it talks about non-prime agricultural land, unless continued or renewed agriculture use is not feasible. You know, what should I take as a definition of not feasible?
Well, that would be through quite a bit of study and analysis, particularly not only on the local level, but through that Coastal Commission level as well. There will be a number of policies that you'll have and that the Coastal Act has for protection of agriculture land, including non-prime agriculture land. So
so it wouldn't be something as simple as the given landowner says, I can't make a profit raising this crop. Because I'm thinking the particular individual's his mortgage, the state of his technology, his skill as a farmer could dictate profit feasibility, but we're not talking about that.
I mean, that may be a consideration. It really is on a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
Yeah.
Martha, in your studies, do you have a sense of how many acres there are in the city limits of agricultural land?
I don't. You might have that in some of your background reports on... Okay.
It can't be much.
Right.
About
200 acres in the city limits?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, for archaeological resources discovery, these, again, are existing practices that are really related to if resources are discovered during construction, that they, you know, construction activities need to cease, you need to notify the appropriate people. There will be a separate cultural resource protection overlay district for your archaeologically and paleontologically sensitive areas. So this is just the standard thing that applies to everybody. You hit archaeological resources during construction, you got to stop and do some things. The next section is coastal access, and these are the procedures and the standards for either the preservation, dedication, or improvements of coastal access. These are consistent with the Coastal Act. They include the basic standards for lateral access, vertical access, and public access ways. They are the implementation component of, or a part of the implementation component of your lateral access plan. But again, these are kind of the standards and the procedures for doing that, for getting that with development.
Is this in all the zone, citywide, so it's any zone?
Right.
Will this clarify, I hate to bring it up, but the nightmare a couple of years ago, the people up north had to go through with that perceived right-of-way through their, next to their house up north in Yerba Buena.
This has nothing to do with that.
So... this won't fix...
There's nothing to fix there.
Okay.
That was an issue that outside folks had with the development application that came forward and the moving of a lateral access path, you know, from its current location to a new location to allow that lot to be developed. That didn't have anything to do with our policy.
And I ask these things throughout, Scott, just hoping that as I watch the commissions and see these things transpire, that we can maybe put something... in the language that would help avoid some of those things in the future.
That's interest groups.
Well.
But maybe I'm just being too Pollyannish about it.
Well, no, I mean, that's actually a good point and a good way to look at these things, actually, especially from this committee, this board's position. That's fantastic. But that specific issue that you raise is one where, you know, there's an outside interest group that viewed that and said, no, you can't move it.
Okay.
And that lot shouldn't be developed. And we don't. This is the one prime piece of lateral of beach access that we have in this location, and we don't want it to go away. The city didn't feel that way. We looked around and saw that there were several other access ways to the beach, and that they were just relocating a little bit, and found that to be an acceptable solution. As did the courts, I guess. But that's an interest group out there that had a specific interest in that specific issue, moving the path, and there's not really anything you're going to put in a code that's going to address that.
Okay. And it's not a criticism of either side. It's just, would there have been something we could have done to avoid that?
Right.
In the regs.
Now, sometimes you can't avoid those types
okay.
of things.
So a question on, so this would be standards for public access. It would be 1D... 1, 2, 3, page 43.
Mm-hmm.
So you can waive your lateral access requirements in any of the following situations. The first is that it's physically infeasible. So you have some issue topographically, you know, geologically, whatever, that you really can't have access. And then it suggests in part 3 there that you would pay an in-lieu fee instead of access that's not possible to have anyhow. Is that really fair? I mean, if the person says, well, I don't want to allow access because I really need a private therapy swimming pool in my backyard, so I don't want to allow access, then I could see paying an in-lieu fee, maybe.
but if you just actually physically, there's no way to get the access in there, is it fair to make them pay extra?
Well, you're saying physically. I mean, it might be more along the lines of it's working waterfront type stuff, and they mm-hmm. have cranes, and they literally offload boats every day, or most days. Do you really want to put some sort of lateral access that runs through there that makes people in conflict with it? So maybe you can move it over, but maybe you can't.
Right.
And so then you have them pay, say, hey, the cost of putting this in here, we understand you don't want to do it. We agree it shouldn't go here because this is working waterfront stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you come up with, but the lateral access way, we know how wide it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be 10 foot, and if you put it here, it would cost this much to put it in, and there's a cost associated with that. We can take that money and use it to improve other lateral access components along in that area because we think you're right. We think you shouldn't have to do this, and we think maybe it's dangerous to put people in this location because you're, again, working waterfront business, as
right.
an example.
Right.
We don't want you to get run over by a forklift, that type of thing. So.
Okay.
And we have a current example of that over at Giovanni's. You can walk through there during the hours he allows you to walk through there.
Yeah, that was a...
But
that's,
then he posts up and shuts it down when he's unloading.
Yeah, that's. That there is a good compromise. We say, hey, yep, you're supposed to have it. Go put it in. And we didn't even do that, Cindy and I, actually. And we worked it out. He goes, but I'm loading up offloading boats here. And we're like, well, you can close it down when you're doing that. That's fine. Just put it on your gate and then close your gate, and it works great. So that's one. That's another solution to it as well. And that's that opportunity is offered in here as well. But you might just have a situation where you're unloading constantly and it doesn't make sense, or you need all the equipment that's on there or specialized equipment that can't be moved and would be in the way or something.
You know, Scott, the only thing that bothers me about that, again, is this physical feasibility, infeasibility, that gets conflated with profitability. I'm a call in a number of occasions when, you know, the naval architects have come and said, well, we really don't want to do that because we have to put down so many pilings and we have to put down, what are they called, revetments, concrete things, and they're very, very expensive. But, I don't think that's what this is getting to, and I kind of wish there was something in that would say, and we're not talking about significant expense, we're talking about physical, I don't want to say impossibility, but you know what I
know where you're going, I'm just not...
I don't know how you do that. I mean...
I guess I would say that happens. So this is, again, not something that somebody could actually just come in and say, well, you know, it's physically impossible, there's some plants there, there's topography doesn't work, so here's some money. It really goes through a lot of analysis to you know, make sure that it is in fact infeasible, or in order to provide it you would be creating such a disturbance that it's not appropriate. And then also the in lieu fee that would need to be paid is also put through a lot of analysis too of what is the appropriate fee, or what is a comparable type of access to be provided. So there's a lot of study and analysis that goes into it. And again, this will not only happen at the city level, it will happen at the Coastal Commission level as well. And one of their primary charges under the Coastal Act is providing public access to the coast. So they'll be, the city will be coordinating with the Coastal Commission in their analysis at the city level, because we all know it would go up to them for review anyway. So it's just not something that's taken lightly, I would say.
So I'm not, in the last couple of years, current with the state beach access for ADA, but is that going to have any thing into this as far as could the developers say, well, I can't achieve ADA access, or do we require that as part of our lateral access to the coast? Do we require
lateral access
ADA?
Requires, so you're putting in new paths, has to be ADA.
So then should we, besides the physical infeasibility like Joe's talking about, maybe we should put language in there as far as ADA also or not? I mean, if a developer comes and brings that up to you, we don't even have any language in there. He says, well, I'm asking for an exemption because can't meet ADA requirements.
Right.
And we don't have anything in our, we're not speaking to it, then don't we look a little silly?
I mean, it does look like, though, that the types of lateral access ways the footage, you know, 10 feet wide, 12 feet, those would be ADA numbers, I would think.
Well,
it's not saying, you know, it doesn't say you can't do steps, but it's suggesting.
Well, it doesn't speak to the percentage on
any
fall.
You're opening up to the public are required to be accessible.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, again, yeah, it's a federal law. It's been in place for almost 30 years now or something.
It is, and I mean.
Does that mean every? Oh, I'm sorry.
We were sued a couple of times at Escondido with, because we didn't have the language at least speak to it. So, I mean, should we just be considering putting that in there? So even, let's look at it from another way. Let's look at it, the feds coming in saying, you don't have any provision for ADA. Your code doesn't even speak to ADA for beach access. We're going to nail you.
We don't need to have reference or repeat all federal regulations.
Assume that we'll follow them.
Right. It's assume, you know, we need to follow them. I guess the other point is that you'll have a number of policies as well related to access and your lateral and your access plan. Mm-hmm. So all that needs to be consistent with this. We don't need to repeat everything in there, in here, and every place. They all kind of work together. And then these are also what's in here are the minimum requirements, and you pointed out the dimensions. So those are the minimum requirements. If there's a wider requirement either required by state federal law, you know, maybe accessibility dimensions change or a condition of approval or as part of the plan, you know, consistency with another plan that, you know, it's just this is the minimum. So the next part is demolition of buildings and structures. And this is a new section, determine whether a demolition has occurred. And it's interesting because there is a big question of what actually is a demolition and what is a remodel. Comes up often, particularly in trying to retain nonconforming features. And also in the coastal zone, demolition is considered development, and you are required to have a coastal development permit for it. So this is to provide some clarity and measurable standards for demolition. The next is development on substandard lots, which is a new section, but it's really just articulating current requirements that if you have a substandard lot that was legally created, it can be used as a building site. You can't reduce it in size any further. You can't further that thing that makes it substandard. But
I'm sorry. Back to the demolition. Does that do away with the old wives' tale of if I leave one wall standing, it's a remodel?
Right.
Okay. Good.
Exactly.
It's an issue that comes up regularly.
Oh gosh, yes.
And then the next section is encroachments into required setbacks. So it carries forward existing encroachment allowances. For things such as eaves, chimneys, bay windows, or so on to encroach into setbacks. It does include, we have added some additional allowances for those small structures and other things such as rain barrels, cisterns, those low impact developments, stormwater treatment things, just clarifying where those are allowed.
So those can go to the lot line, right? The rain barrels can go right onto the lot line.
In the interior side and in the rear setback.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The next section is fences and freestanding walls. And what this section does is, and we talked a little bit about some of the refinements, but carrying forward the existing standards with some new limitations on materials, particularly hazardous fencing, chain link, and concrete block limitations. So chain link would be prohibited in residential districts. Concrete block needs to be finished with stucco or capped. And then some refinements to allowable fence height in front and street side setbacks. So this has a proposal to increase the solid fence allowance in front and street side setbacks from 3 feet to 4 feet. And then for open fences, the maximum height increase from 4 feet to 5 feet. And then in addition to that, since we drafted this, staff has been considering exceptions to height limits. And sometimes there are situations, and staff can elaborate on some specific ones that have come up, where it makes sense to allow some higher fence heights in street side setbacks. So they want to consider a new option to allow an exceedance of fence height standards by potentially up to 2 feet, with director approval based on certain findings such as security, safety, and then, you know, making sure that, you know, it's safe, you know, safe not only for the people who have the fence but others in the vicinity. The current code does allow a 10% height increase with a minor variance, but if we're looking at, you know, on a 4 foot fence, that's 4.8 inches, so that's really not much of some flexibility. So looking that at a fence height exception, it could be a discretionary process or with director approval.
So, you know, we don't have a whole lot of it in Morro Bay, but is there anything about pools? Because generally they have to be fenced for safety. And I would think a certain height so kids don't climb
five,
over.
5 feet.
There's a requirement for building permits for pools, yeah.
Yeah, it's required to have a fence around 5 feet, I think.
So you said on your little handout, it says limits on chain link, and then in the regs you're actually saying chain link fencing is not permitted in residential districts.
It's not permitted now.
Oh, it isn't now?
No. It comes forward. It hasn't changed.
Oh, so all the chain link fences I see in town are not there? No, it says are not permitted in residential districts.
Yeah, they're not allowed in residential districts now.
So all the ones I see are not permitted.
They're either non-conforming or they put them up without
knowing
our codes, that type of thing.
Okay.
Again, non-conforming situation. Is that issue that I brought up we were talking about earlier? It can create the situation. So we know our codes have been in place for 30 years.
At least.
And so they were potentially put up during that time frame. So they were put up illegally. And so if we went around and made everybody take them out, how many people in town have them?
Oh, I'm not. Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah. I'm going back to the logic. What was the logic of saying no chain link fences? Because we still allow them in Escondido. I just wonder how we got to that.
I think
point.
Mostly it's an aesthetic thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. But yeah. We encourage colored, coated to make it.
Oh, okay.
Like black. Make it go away.
Yeah.
So they're all.
Any thoughts on the height thing? Is it reasonable that the director could entertain an exception?
I always like the idea of allowing exceptions. I do think there's a lot of reasons people can come up with, whether it's, you know, children or dogs or pools or so. I just think we have to. We know that the people who work for this city are reasonable people, or we get rid of them. so I just think, you know, you have to allow that it's a community of people who may have different needs and ideas, and I think that's good.
And we could certainly add it. We could make the process an administrative process that we notice on, if you'd like. I mean, that's. Happy to do that. Right now, one of the issues that we run into right now is, for protection purposes, you have to have a guardrail. Guardrail height is 42 inches. Our maximum height in the front yard right now is 3 feet. So I have to allow someone to put a guardrail in. It's not a fence. I go, well, so I'm splitting hairs, right? I'm like, okay, that's a guardrail, not a fence. Our code doesn't deal with guardrails, and so it can be 42 inches tall. If they have a drop-off that's over 30 inches, they have to have a guardrail along it. And so you can have a much taller fence. And this actually kind of accommodates those types of things, because when you have grade separations and grade differentials, that 3 feet thing doesn't do me any good whatsoever. And I just have to kind of ignore it and go, building code says you have to do this, so here you go.
And the other thing I wanted to add, my observation in working at the city, is that a nuance is there are some unique shaped lots in Morro Bay. And so I've had people come to me at the counter, and when they find out the fence regulations, they say, well, that technically, you know, I use that as my backyard, but it faces the street, and I have to have it lower, and, you know, my dog will jump the fence. And, you know, so This would be a nice feature to add because it allows flexibility not only for security and the guardrail issue, but then also for acknowledging irregular shaped lots in the city.
You also have correspondence in the packet from Glenn and Joanne Thielen, you know, that speak to the fence issue and the nonconforming issue and those types of things and wanting taller fences and that type of stuff. And they're sort of representative of several folks in their neighborhood that spoke to me at a meeting a little while ago. So anyway, yeah, they provided that to you because he wasn't able to come to the meeting tonight. So
I agree with Susan about the allowance, but I think these little nickel and dime things need to be allowed for you to approve and not have to dump them on planning for the time, and it's just crazy.
And
I think it, with respect to the fences and hedges, particularly the back fence on sloping property, it's 6.5 feet. It really doesn't provide any privacy to the home above you, and the home above you doesn't really object either because they're higher and a higher fence isn't blocking their view either. So it's actually a better idea.
Yeah, that's the situation that we run into is those type. It comes up in those types of exactly those situations. I mean, like, our code doesn't really let you to deal with it. You're just kind of like, sorry, that's the code. You know, so having some flexibility to deal with things like that is what we're asking for, basically.
The next section is on height exceptions, really. So your current provisions are really limited but vague at the same time. Ventilation stacks and chimneys under 6 feet in width or length can exceed the height limit. That's just it. And then, but chimneys over 6 feet in width, and then a menu of other things can exceed the height limit with minor use permit approval. So what this section does is provide more details about specific elements that may project and the maximum allowable projection for that specific element. So including things, as was mentioned earlier, elevator and stair towers, things like that. And then there's typically limitations on, you know, how much of the roof area or the size of them.
Made me think of something that I think someone came here and complained about, flagpole heights, and we're going to be looking at that too.
We need to put a standard.
There was an issue for flagpoles somewhere that they came to us about early on. Just thought of it.
The section on lighting and illumination has some minimum standards for multi-unit residential development and non-residential buildings, and then height limits for lighting fixtures, and then a number of limitations for protection of the night sky, so minimizing that outdoor artificial light and the light trespass. So these complement building code requirements that, you know, fairly recently have, as they've been updated, really provide a lot of standards for prohibiting glare and unshielded fixtures.
Are there different provisions in commercial districts versus residential districts for this night sky thing?
I'd have to look in the building code at how that is structured.
Just because I think, you know, we hear a lot of talk about encouraging more nighttime activity in the commercial districts in Morro Bay. Streets are dark. Nobody wants to walk on them. Doesn't feel comfortable and safe. And when you talk about our commercial districts in Morro Bay, you're really talking about kind of three streets, maybe four. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, you've got the Quintana Corridor, which is its own thing with the big parking lots, and those I think are fairly well lit. But you've got Morro Bay Boulevard, Main Street, the Embarcadero, somewhat North Main, but I don't think anybody's right now concerned about walkability up there at night. But, yeah, okay, so, yeah. But I know we were trying something at my shop, staying open late on Fridays, and did not get a lot of foot traffic. There are not a lot of people wandering around at night after dark in Morro Bay in the winter. So, but, and I think some of that's they're not used to the idea that people are doing this or trying to. But some of it's that you look out there and it's kind of dark. So
it's so it, it, I mean, that issue in general, I mean, making it a little brighter down there, I don't know that it would actually run afoul of policies like this because it talks about the type of lighting that you use, and then shielded lighting from above, right? So it's focused downward onto the sidewalks and the street, sort of, right? So, and then sort of what the wattage and the intensity of that light is, so it doesn't, you don't have that light spill effect into the sky. I think that's really what we're talking about. More to your issue is that's one of the things we're going to be talking about with the chamber and so forth as part of the implementation of the economic development strategic plan. I have had a little bit of conversation with Erica on that, and it is something I plan on picking back up and starting to move forward after the first of the year.
So the next section carries forward existing provisions for motorhomes and recreational vehicles that you can't use them as a residence, can't maintain them in your front yard, can't connect them to utilities. So those are your existing provisions carried forward. And then there's a new section on open space. So we talked about the requirements for open space with certain types of development. And then this talks about how those need to be configured, including minimum dimensions, usability, accessibility. And this is really to make sure that they're usable open spaces and not, you know, this tiny sliver combined with that tiny sliver, and overall I meet the requirements, but they're no one can actually use that open space. So this is what areas designated as open space need to have to qualify.
Scott, how is this going to relate to the, I think we're in abeyance on the enforcement of the boats and things on the north end?
Yeah, we've taken a little while to bring that back. We have a bunch of information to bring back. We're going to start with the Planning Commission probably in January or February and then move to City Council with that, at which point we'll have to plug in whatever comes out of that into the zoning code update portion of it. So this is current standards, status quo. We're not changing anything because we haven't gotten direction to do that. It's been pushed off a little bit just because we've had, you know, I mean, we've had a lot of things going on with the water reclamation facility, and we've sort of tried to get that back up and rolling, and, you know, we had a lot of people that are interested in that, and, you know, it's having one conflict going on at a time is kind of nice as opposed to several.
Sure.
And so we're going to be picking that up again after the first of the year and coming forward with it. It's just we've sort of been pushing it off a little bit because of where things were with the wharf, and having multiple meetings like that, you know, or multiple items like that, it council meetings, it makes it kind of difficult to get any business done there. And it's a little strategic, but it actually, we need to get business done at the city council meetings. And if we're having several meetings on what you can put in your front yard while we're doing the wharf thing, it just doesn't make sense.
Sure. And then I assume that this section 17, 14, 120 only pertains to private property as far as not habitating. What I'm getting at is the motorhomes that are parked on the street that people are sleeping in becomes a police enforcement 72-hour issue.
Well, and you can't stay in them either on the street.
Well, right, but...
Yes.
So
it's
that's...
This is private property.
It's a police, yeah,
separate,
these things all deal with
just
private property.
Just kind of clarifying that for...
Yeah. We have other municipal code sections that deal with those.
Exactly.
Other
all right, thank you.
And the next section is on outdoor storage. So it's a new section with standards for, this applies to the storage of things for more than 72 hours. So in residential and commercial and mixed use district, it's outdoor storage is not permitted. In industrial, it's permitted as an accessory use, primary use with a conditional use permit. There are location and screening requirements, as well as in other districts, there's location and screening requirements and where it's allowed as an accessory use. And then refuse and storage collection, this is carrying forward your existing provisions, which really kind of are a reference to the requirements of Title VIII. And there's certain requirements for level of development and type, location, and method of screening approved by the director. The next section is on screening, and so these standards are primarily carried forward, and they're screening for mechanical and electrical equipment, some screening along common property lines, the outdoor storage areas, so on. One thing that we did modify is that your current provisions require screening of all non-residential uses that abut a residential use. or any use in a C2 district that abuts another zoning district. And that requirement was a 6-foot-high solid masonry fence. And as we think about having connectivity and mixes of uses in between some of these districts and within them, that really was a barrier. And so we modified those requirements for the common property lines. So it's really when any use in the industrial use classification or some of these transportation and communication utilities uses abut a residential district. So we really don't want to, you know, have barriers between, you know, a community commercial district and a residential use, because we think those are ones, you know, having this walkable mixed use area. So that's a refinement we included in them.
Will this have the same provision as far as giving Scott the authority for the increase in height if necessary?
We could clarify that, yeah, that increase would apply to screening as well. I have to look at this language. I think this is the minimum, but we'll review that. And then also, we will have some things for other transitions and compatibility landscape buffers that will be in the landscaping section. So I just wanted to let you know that.
Back to the wall, and you said you don't want it. Did I hear you say you don't want walls between residential and a commercial?
Not all residential and commercial uses, no.
Suppose about for noise attenuation for the commercial part.
It depends on use.
Okay.
On what the commercial use is. If it's a mixed-use commercial project that's got residential in it, you might want to have the connection between it, because you people going both ways, because there's the coffee shop there that the people in the residential apartment complex that's next door can get, you know, can walk over there.
I get
through the thing, as opposed to going around or whatever.
But we have other language that would, if there is a noise issue, that would, we could put that in still. This wouldn't prohibit.
This doesn't prohibit that. So if there were a noise issue, that would be triggered through your noise.
Noise ordinance? Yeah.
Right,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then appropriate attenuation measures would be.
That's what I was, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's see. Storage and parking of vehicles for sale. This is current provisions carried forward. Swimming pools and spas, your existing setback requirements are carried forward. There are other standards that were in there specific to swimming pools and spas, but really are incorporated into other sections of the code, noise and lot coverage sections. As far as the provisions here do work with the requirements of the building code, which does include those fencing and security measures. Underground utilities need to be installed underground unless infeasible. And again, that would be working with the director on that determination. And then finally, visibility at intersections, which is carrying forward your existing provisions of, you know, visibility at intersections where things meet. And that's really the city engineer's purview. So then the end of the section is really, or definitions, and those were provided as reference. They will be refined again as we go forward and we hear on the general plan from the Coastal Commission, also as different terms get added in there. But this is our best guess at this point, and any comments that come up on it, we'd be happy to entertain.
And they'll end up being in the front. When we get this done, right?
At the end, we usually actually put them in back, definitions in back at the end,
okay.
You know, as a referencing.
So we're at 6 o'clock. Is everybody okay to keep going? Because I bet we don't have a whole lot more to cover with the lateral access poster, Amy? Or?
The lateral access poster is there, but unfortunately, the way that we noticed the hearing, it was
okay.
From 4 to 6. We need to really kind of wrap it up at 6-ish. If we left it open at the end, it would be fine to move forward. But usually we have a meeting after ours, and that meeting was canceled. So.
Okay.
But they weren't sure before when we set this, so couldn't really leave it that way.
Okay. So, Scott, I have just a logistical question that's getting all, maybe it's only crazy in my mind. On the underground utilities that you're going to require that everything be installed underground, unless it's infeasible, unless it's not feasible. Well, if you is this apply to residential areas too? Because I'm picturing somebody building a new residence that has electric wires above the ground on both sides, and they have to put theirs underground.
That's how it works. Usually you're talking, you have your phone line, you have your telephone lines, your cable lines, those types of things. And so you'd be putting conduit in, you do a drop down the pole that's closest to you, and then you bring it into the lot. So sometimes it's not feasible to bring electricity in that way. Like for commercial projects, PG&E won't let you underground 12 kV and above because they don't want a bunch of drops of 12 kV lines running down poles, because if you hit that, you're probably not going to make it beyond that with a car, so they don't like you to do that. So they like you to do, when you're doing bigger lines, to have them done in longer stretches. But individual lines going into houses are typically pretty feasible, depending on where the poles are located. So
it's possible then you can have a house with no wires around it and one with wires around it. Mm-hmm. And the other ones will not be changed unless the owners decide to change it.
Right. Or as properties redevelop. We don't have the ability. I mean, people tell us all the time, we want you to, you know, why aren't we underground? Why isn't the city undergrounding all the lines? Because it's very expensive. Yeah, so you can't. It's pretty infeasible unless you go through an undergrounding district, and then it would be placed on, you know, all of your tax bills or however the district's formed. But trying to get people to agree to that when you tell them what the cost is, it doesn't typically go very well.
So it wasn't so muddled in my mind, because that's how I was picturing it, and I get okay.
It's just that's the way to get it done over time. I mean, that's about the best we can do, sort of. People out there in neighborhoods saying, we want to form our own district, and then the city can help you do that. But without that happening, the city doesn't have the funds to do it.
So I just wanted to say, we will be at a time to be scheduled taking this for review with the Planning Commission. And so we went through a lot of stuff. There's a lot of information in there. I think it would be helpful to go through it again, you know, with fresh eyes. And then if there's anything to pass on, either, you know, pass that on to staff or come to the Planning Commission review of it. And we would be, happy to get that input.
Is the Planning Commission meeting going to be prior to our next January meeting that's scheduled on our agenda here? Okay, so we can come back with questions, or should we email questions between now and then?
You can send us questions, comments related to any of this stuff anytime you'd like.
Okay.
We'll take it at any point.
All right.
And then eventually you'll see it back in the sort of finalized format with the changes and what we've gotten out of the Planning Commission when we go there and that type of thing.
So at our next meeting, will we have the opportunity to ask any questions about today's items, or will we be moving on to something new?
Well, we will definitely do lateral access next time.
Yep.
So you have a sneak peek here, but we'll go through it completely.
Okay.
And we may have some additional information for you by then as well on that task. But were you asking about the zoning?
I was just wondering I can send questions, but there were some things I was hoping to kind of maybe go back and clarify. If we had time next time to kind of just ask those questions, maybe.
So are you asking if Martha's coming back next month?
Well, yeah, we like Martha.
I don't think we have zoning. We weren't going to have anything related to zoning on the next agenda, right?
No. I don't think we'll have the new stuff.
Okay, then I'll just send my questions and
send them in, and hopefully they can be addressed
electronically,
or we can even
perfect.
Yeah, we could even report back at the next meeting about whatever questions you might have. We can allocate some time for that.
Perfect. Yeah.
And for clarification, these that we saw tonight have already been addressed by the Coastal Commission or run by the Coastal Commission?
No.
And they next go to the Planning Commission.
Then go to there. Okay.
So just to refresh our memories, the plan, the general plan, local coastal program, is moving ahead of the zoning code update. So that's what has had some initial review from the Coastal Commission, and the whole plan will go to them very soon. But the zoning is running a little bit behind that. Yeah.
Okay, any comments, closing comments from the committee?
What part, when the meetings we missed the last few months, what part were they looking at that we had to wait for?
They looked at the alternatives that you've already seen having to do with the plan and some of the preliminary policy language. They also have been looking at some of the memos and analysis that go with this third grant that was received, so the low-cost accommodation analysis, the analysis of environmentally sensitive habitat areas. And so we've brought most of those items to the GPAC as well, but they have been looking at those. So we had a meeting with them a couple months ago where we received some feedback. The sea level rise analysis is another piece. Okay. So all of that goes into the plan. Like earlier we were talking about lateral access zoning. There's also policy language in Plan Morro Bay for that, and we'll be coming back to you to get your specific input next month on that issue. But okay. So it's kind of these separate analyses, more focused analyses that we've had the opportunity to work on that will all be part of the plan. That's some of the stuff we've been working with the Coastal Commission on.
Okay. Well, I know we've been told we were on hold waiting for them, so I'm assuming since we're meeting here today, they must have blessed whatever we needed them to bless.
We
to
got really good
forward.
Feedback on some of those items, yeah, and so we're finalizing some of that stuff, and then it's all part of that, the draft plan.
They even
well.
Told us we were being too tough on our ash policies.
Yeah, nice.
That was
when do you ever hear the Coastal Commission tell you that?
Good
so,
job.
Our next meeting is January 18th, and I think everything else on here we've already covered, so I'll turn it back over to Susan.
All right. I think unless anybody else has any other comments and you're done. Scott, you got anything?
I don't have anything specific now.
All right. Everybody.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays for sure. Thank you.
Yeah.